Transmitting sound. Download complete. Now launching audio stream. The Kelly Alexander Show.
We're locked and loaded this week with celebrity trainer Tony Martinez talking about kids and fitness, especially during the summer months. Space expert Rod Pyle talks about Skylab and what is happening in the private sector of space exploration. Ever wonder why you don't get great seats at your favorite concert? Social media expert Patrick Charles tells us why. We also speak to the founder of the Peace and Prosperity Alliance, Lisa Gibson, about the importance of forgiveness. And then we wrap things up with a remix from Ariana Grande, The Way.
Capture your need for sound.
We're very excited to welcome back to the show an amazing fitness trainer who works with the likes of Britney Spears, the Jonas Brothers, and Pink, not to mention his long-standing relationship with Janet Jackson. You can learn all about him on his awesome website, trainertonymartinez.com. Tony, welcome back to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thank you for having me back, Kelly.
So, Tony, I wanted to start off by talking about summer fitness, especially when it comes to kids. And I wanted your take on this. Do you think kids are actually more fit in the summer because they're not in school and they can run around? Or are they more sedentary because they're not in their regular gym classes and regular organized sports school activities?
You know, it's a catch-22 because, you know, you would think, you know, in school they would tell you to do more activities. You know, at least you get an hour. But it's so funny because it drives me crazy that these kids are not outside playing. I mean, you have great weather in the summertime to either go to the beach, you know, go to the playground, go to the park, get your rollerblades on and go on a bike ride with friends, get on your skateboard, do anything like that just to have fun. And kids would rather just, you know, stay and do the video games, which drives me crazy.
So you said it, I guess it depends on the family and the kid, right? If they kick the kid out to actually exercise or run around.
Yeah, and it helps if it's a family outing, too. You know, they all go on a bike ride, they all go on a hike, they all go to the beach together, play a little volleyball. You know, anything like that, that would help the kids as well, too, you know, to get them energized. But the whole family gets, you know, activity as well.
That's what I wanted to ask you about as well, like family activity. Obviously, it's something that you encourage. Now, do you encourage it that they, you know, because a lot of times parents are very busy during the week. How many times a week do you hope for a family activity, like on the weekends, or do you hope maybe at least three times a week the family is doing something physical together?
Wow, I would hope three times a week, you know, even if it's just, you know, if you have a dog or something like that, you can always, you know, say after you have your dinner, even if you walk 20 minutes with your dog outing, just for, you know, a gingerly walk, that would help a lot too.
Okay. And how much activity should a child be getting? And now, like, let's say between the ages of 6 and 12, you know, what type of activity do you want to see them getting on a daily basis? And where are your thoughts on teenagers?
Well, definitely I would like to get them at least a minimum of 30 minutes of activity. Doesn't matter what it is, anything, you know. Even if, you know, you can go window shopping with your mom and dad too, you know, walking around the mall, that old thing too. But teenagers now they're a little bit more active now. So we want to get them a little more, you know, get their metabolism, because metabolism is going to burn up anyway. So we want them to be more active to where they could, you know, do a little more playing soccer for back-to-back or basketball or something like that, just to keep them moving the whole entire time.
Do you think, Tony, that parents should start their kids off at a young age in an organized sport, you know, maybe outside of school, like, let's say, like a soccer league, so that, you know, hopefully that will carry with them into their teen years? Because I know in teenagehood, sometimes you don't feel like doing anything other than sitting in your room and writing poetry. But I'm assuming it'd be very good if they had some sort of activity going on to even just mentally help them through being a teenager.
You know, it really does help anything at a young age, you know. I can only speak for myself and, you know, my family members around me that I have around, that we are pretty active from, you know, the age of 3, from getting a soccer ball playing around, or my mom would make us, you know, right away, hey, we are going to go right to the park. And we were like 4 years old. We're like, what are we doing? We don't even have training wheels, you know, just something like that to keep us going, but it's definitely helpful.
How should parents set an example for their kids when it comes to physical activity?
You know, they need to be a part of their lives. That's the whole thing. I mean, obviously they are, but at the same time, you know, just have fun with them, play games with them, you know, anything active with them. Just because, you know, the parents are looking, I mean, the kids are looking for the parents for role models to get them, you know, physically fit.
Joining us on the Kelly Alexander Show is fitness trainer Tony Martinez. Make sure you check him out on his website, trainertonymartinez.com. You can also follow him on Twitter @trainertony. What happens, Tony, if you have a parent or parents who are overweight? How do you make sure that maybe their position doesn't get instilled in their kids? Because, you know, hopefully the kids will not have weight issues.
Well, basically, you take it one day at a time, okay? Take it step by step, you know, make realistic goals. You know, if anything, you know what? Let's just walk with the parents right now, if anything. Let's just, you know, gingerly, you know, do some kind of activity. Any movement is good. Any kind of movement is good with the parent and the child. Just anything moving, because just because, you know, they're probably, you know, they work a lot. They're stressed out a lot. The parents, you know, they got to pay their mortgage. They got to do this. They got other things on their mind that they got to think going here. And it's hard for the child to, you know, they get neglected a little bit in that sense, but you have to find that way to motivate your child to keep moving anything.
Now, how important is it when we speak about nutrition and sleep in all of this?
Wow, that's the, you know what, because I always said before, smart nutrition is half the battle of anything that we do. Exercise, we can all do that, okay? We can always move anywhere, but smart nutrition is half the battle. I mean, if anything, what they need, you know, what would be helpful is just, you know, just write out what you like to eat, because everybody writes, everybody tells you what you cannot eat. Well, why don't you find out what you can eat, and then we can figure it out how to work from there.
Okay. And when it comes to sleep, especially if we're talking about kids, obviously sleep is very important for them, but I assume it's also very important when it comes to physical activity and maybe even body repair work while they're sleeping.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they always say, you know, 8 hours a day, you know, gosh, I would kill for 8 hours a day for sleep. Especially for a child, because they're still growing, you know, they're still growing into their bodies, you know. So definitely, at least, you know, once they get, you know, like on a routine, you know, sleep-wise, you know, after your homework, after you, you know, you've finished, you know, playing the basketball game, you know, if you can get some good quality sleep, that'd be great.
What do you say to someone who is around the age of 21? Because I know, for example, that if I understand things correctly, your metabolism slows quite a bit at the age of 21 because you're not really needing to grow anymore. So what do you tell people in their early 20s who might have been able to sort of skate by on not doing much, but now, you know, the food might stick?
I'd say, see what happens? This is where you're supposed to be eating good during that time. I say, you know what? It's good. And I tell all my clients that, and they always tell me this all the time, is that, how come I could eat all these things and now it doesn't happen? You know, what's going on? I'm like, well, you have to have a lifestyle change here. I mean, you have to eat properly now. I mean, it's okay. We could get away with it when we were younger because our metabolism's going so fast. Now that it slows down, well, we have to, you know, eat the proper carbohydrates, fats, and proteins.
Now, we've discussed that you work with a lot of celebrities, and obviously they have jam-packed schedules and all that sort of stuff. And I'm assuming that some of them actually are probably sleep-deprived, you know, if they're traveling all over the place and stuff. What's your biggest tip for them, you know, when it comes to needing to stay active, even though they're on a crazy schedule and going from time zone to time zone?
Well, but what I do is I bring, you know, I tell them basically, listen, we're going to go how you feel, first of all. I mean, if you're tired, there's no reason to work out in that sense because you're not going to be doing any good to me at all. I need your body to repair itself. So basically, when they get enough sleep, then we go and, you know, we give them some nice, cool, you know, more like a gingerly exercise just to get their whole body moving again. I do a lot more stretching for them as well during that time since, you know, they're still jet-lagged. They have so much on their mind. Just to relax them a little bit. And then the next following day, then I'm like, you know what, we're going to hit it hard now, okay? You're done. But I only do like more, I might do like between 20 and 30 minutes of, you know, little interval training, you know, athletic interval training, just to have some fun with them. You know, I bring my little travel fit bag with my core disc and my bands that are in there, and they love that thing because we really don't need a gym, you know, so that's the best part about it. So, and it just makes them feel a little bit better afterwards.
Now, can you give us an idea, for example, like we've talked about you working with Janet and Pink and Brittany. Now, all of these people, when they're out on tour, are obviously expending a lot of energy by being on stage dancing around. Like, you know, we've been able to see them in action, and obviously they are getting a lot of exercise when they're on stage. What do you do with them, though, on their off days? Because do you want them to rest, or do you still have them do some cardio? Like, what happens with them because they're doing, you know, putting on two-hour stage shows?
Right. I tell them it's all about recovery. Everything is about recovery, you know. We stretch them out. I stretch them out, basically. I make sure that, you know, they're limber, you know. But some of them, they want to keep going, you know. They want to, like, I want to work out hard. I'm like, I have to hold the reins back a little bit because, you know, they're so amped up because they feed off the energy off of the audience, mm-hmm. you know, that gets them hyped up, that feels, makes them feel good. They're on that high. And it's harder for them to come down, you know. It's harder for them to come down. So that's why I always tell them, you know, during the tour time, let's work out smarter, not harder.
What do you do, Tony, when they come off stage? Like when Janet comes off stage, does she have time to sort of stretch out then? Because I'm assuming that, you know, she's been jumping up and down for 2 hours, and like those muscles, like you said, need to be worked out before she goes and sits on a tour bus.
You know, I treat them all like athletes, you know, all the entertainers, Brittany, Janet, everybody, when they get off stage, what I do is, you know, I ice them down, I ice them, ice their knees, their back, I stretch them. I'm like, you know, I feel like they went through like a basketball, football game, you know, just so that they feel good for the next performance.
And are you concerned at all about their footwear? Because, like, it's one thing when they're working out with you in a gym and they've got their proper running shoes on, but, you know, we've seen them be in heels and be in boots and all this stuff on stage. Are you concerned about their well-being because of their costumes?
Every single time. Because, you know, that little heel puts so much pressure on their knees and their lower back, you know. But I'm not the choreographer, so that's not on them, you know. They, you know, because the choreographer has their own methods and their vision and that whole thing. My job is just to make sure that she feels better, you know, if anything. I don't like doing it, but I rub the feet. I'm going to admit to it. I don't like touching feet, but I do it. Okay, just to break up all the little, you know, nodules in the foot and in the lower back, and then, you know, stretch them out. And then I make sure that they're hydrated as well. That's my main thing too, because during that show, they just sweat so much because the lights are so super hot. You know, and they're on them the whole time in those costumes, changing in and out. I make sure that they have, you know, the proper, you know, electrolytes in their system.
Perfect. Tony, before I let you go this time around, can you give us your biggest tip or piece of advice that you want people to have going forth as we launch into summer in North America and other parts around the world? What do you want people to remember in these hot summer months?
Listen, if anything, keep hydrated. That's the main thing right now. It's going to be really, really hot. Just keep drinking your water, okay, no matter what you do. And if you do work out, wear, you know, loose clothes, nothing too tight, too constricted, you know, just because, you know, that basically doesn't mean you circulated enough, no blood flow the whole entire time, but just mainly just hydrate. That's the main thing, hydrate.
Fantastic. Tony, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it.
Sure. Thank you for having me on the show, Kelly. Appreciate it.
That's trainer Tony Martinez. Again, make sure you follow him on Twitter at Trainer Tony and on his website, trainertonymartinez.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
We have just celebrated the 40th anniversary of the space mission that saved Skylab in a heroic, daring repair back in 1973. To talk about what happened, as well as to touch base about what is currently going on in space travel, is Rod Pyle. He's a writer, producer, and director, and notably wrote and produced Modern Marvel's Apollo 11 for the History Channel. Rod, welcome back to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Hi, thanks for having me. How are you?
Very well. So, Rod, to start off, can you talk to us about Skylab? What was this program all about, and what happened when it was actually crippled in orbit?
This was the plans for this were started in the 60s by Wernher von Braun and his folks, and they were trying to figure out how to extend the Apollo program after the moon landing. So they said, you know, we've got all this great software. We're going to have three or four of these rockets left over when we're done. What are we going to do with them? So they talked about maybe flying a loop around Venus. They thought about flying a loop around Mars. They finally decided, look, let's set our sights on Earth and we'll just build a space station. So they took the third stage of the rocket and they outfitted it with all the comforts of home. They actually brought in this industrial designer, Raymond Loewy, to design the interior. He had designed famously the Camel cigarettes package and the Studebaker Avanti. So he was quite the hip guy in his time. So they built this beautiful space station and launched it in 1973, but unfortunately on the way up, one of the solar panels was torn off because a fairing came loose. So once it arrived in orbit, they very rapidly realized that it was getting way too hot and not generating enough power. Now, it went up without a crew, so as far as it went, that was okay, but the crew was supposed to launch the next day, and they realized they were never going to be able to survive in there because it was 135 degrees, and like I said, the power wasn't working properly. So the crew that was supposed to follow up in a second spacecraft stood down for about 2 weeks and tried to figure out how they were going to fix this thing. And then they launched about 12 days later.
And how did they sort of figure out what they needed to do to fix it and what was involved in all of that?
There's a lot of guesswork involved in trying to figure out what exactly had happened, but they finally got a nearby Air Force satellite to sort of turn its camera off the Earth for a while and look over at the space station. They saw that they were missing one whole side of it. So they figured out this sort of rough and ready plan of action. And this is not the kind of thing NASA would do today, but at the time it made a lot of sense to them. So they got in their neutral buoyancy water tank and did a bunch of tests to figure out, okay, this is how we think we could fix it. So by the time they sent them up a couple weeks later, they had a bunch of rope and a bunch of hooks and duct tape and all kinds of stuff, including a tree pruning pole. You know, those things, those 13, 14 foot poles you use to lop off branches. They had one of those broken down to pieces. They jammed all that in that little Apollo command module along with the three astronauts and launched them on a Saturn 1B, a smaller version of the Saturn V. And once they rendezvoused with this poor crippled space station, Pete Conrad, who was kind of a cowboy as it was, you know, was whooping and hollering, "Oh boy, we're here, this is great," and oh dear. And as he got closer, he realized how serious things really were. So they opened the hatch up, and one of the astronauts climbed out and assembled this pole, and the other one held him by the knees and was strapped into a seat. And then there's Pete Conrad trying to fly this command module in a way it was never designed to be flown. So the third guy's outside tugging on the solar panel, trying to get it open. The second guy's trying desperately to hold on to him so he doesn't go drifting off. And the commander is there trying to keep maneuvering this thing so it doesn't bang inside the space station. So this is not the kind of thing that you would see done with the shuttle or with the space station today. It was a little more of a rough and ready brand. But try as they might, they couldn't get it to work on that particular attempt.
And after Skylab was repaired, what happened to it and what purpose did it serve in the grand scheme of things?
Well, once they got it fixed, they finally did manage to tie a rope off the end of that solar panel, and then they tied the other end of it to an airlock, and then two of them went out and climbed underneath the rope and stood up really fast and managed to snap the panel loose and went tumbling off into space in the process, but they had tethers, so it was okay. So they laughed and joked about it. They finished out about a 28-day mission, and then there were two more missions after that that went up and set endurance records. So the idea behind Skylab was to have a first presence in space that went beyond a couple of weeks. We had done, I think, 2 weeks with some of the Gemini flights, but this was Gemini was like sitting in a cramped compact car. It was miserable 2 weeks. The station was about 25 feet by 80 feet, so it was very large. Still the largest single volume actually ever launched into space in one long piece. So they're able to do a lot of motion studies in there. They're able to figure out what happened with bone loss and muscle loss and all that kind of stuff. So there are a lot of physiological studies. They did a lot of astronomy work on the sun. And by the time they had flown their third crew up there, they had set endurance records for any space station flight at the time. So that lasted up through 1974. Then it sat for a few years, kind of waiting to figure out what would happen. The shuttle was supposed to go up in 1979 and boost it to a higher orbit, but the shuttle got delayed and didn't fly till 81. And famously, Skylab re-entered over Australia and broke up into a couple million pieces. Not a happy ending for such a good program.
No, not a happy ending for sure. Joining us on the show is writer, producer, and director Rod Pyle, who produced Modern Marvel's Apollo 11 for the History Channel. Rod, can you talk to us about the private sector of a spaceflight? What is actually happening, for example, with Mars One?
Oh, man, there's so much going on. Well, there have just been a couple of large trade shows, and Mars One was notably represented at both of them. Now, a lot of people get Mars One and Inspiration Mars mixed up. Inspiration Mars is Dennis Tito, the first space tourist, or one of the first space tourists. His program is to take a couple of people and send them out to Mars in a capsule to do a flyby. They're just going to loop around and come back. And that's why he calls it Inspiration Mars, because it's really more about inspiration than science. And that would be 2018. Mars One is a guy named Bas Landorp in Holland who wants to send up colonists starting in 2023 in groups of three or four. And so he wants to send up a rover in 2016, which is coming up really fast. And the rover would look for a landing site, and then he's going to send up in 2018, 2020, start sending up actual unmanned spacecraft that would land and start processing atmosphere and so forth, so these people have something to drink and breathe, and that's done out of the natural elements on Mars. And then in 2022, 2023, he wants to send up a first crew to actually make this one-way trip to colonize the planet, and every 2 years after that, send up a handful more. It's a very ambitious plan with, at this point, not a lot of backing or infrastructure, but, you know, he gives a very inspirational speech, and he gets a lot of people excited, and that's kind of what it's all about. So that's the Mars front. A little closer to home, you've got the two asteroid mining companies, Planetary Resources and Deep Space Industries. They're actually collecting a fair amount of money to try and start going out and prospecting asteroids and doing some work on spotting them in advance and trying to figure out how to divert them from Earth if necessary. And a number of other private companies, of course, SpaceX with their Dragon capsule and Blue Origin and X-Corps with their suborbital space plane. So there's a lot going on and a lot of money being spent, and people are actually starting to fly these things, and it's a really exciting time.
What did you think of Commander Chris Hadfield and his recent mission at the International Space Station? Because he was so active on social media. And to me, like as a sort of third party observer and someone who did end up following him on Twitter, he really seemed to bring excitement to being in space again.
He does. And, you know, the space station's had an image problem for a long time. We've got this very Buck Rogers thing the size of a football field going overhead every 90 minutes. But a lot of people don't know it, and those that do don't find it that interesting. So it's wonderful when a guy like Hadfield can come along and say, you know, I'm going to revitalize this. I'm a multifaceted, multi-hyphenate kind of guy. I mean, you know, it's intimidating enough to meet astronauts. They're overachievers from the very beginning. But then this guy can actually sing, right? He's clearly trained. He's good at it. He pulls off this great performance from orbit and then comes back and kind of continues reaching out to people. So I think it's the best thing that's happened in NASA in a decade or more, other than the Curiosity Mars rover. I mean, on the manned side, the crewed side, he's been a wonderful blessing for them. And, you know, their mandate doesn't really include much on outreach and PR. They have a budget for it, but it's supposed to be a very small part of what they do. And now with the sequestration, the first thing to go was outreach and education. So they really need more people like him, I think, to bring especially the younger crowd into the excitement of space exploration.
Can you talk to us about NASA? You know, the last time you and I spoke, the shuttle program was just about ending. So what's going on with them, and are we going to see anything happening with regards to, because now I think everybody goes up through the Soyuz program, right?
Yeah, we're buying seats on the Russian spacecraft. Kind of ironically, you know, we're buying seats on the same spacecraft that they were building in the early 1960s to try and beat us to the moon. And it failed in that attempt, but it's turned out since then to be an incredibly robust, really reliable way of getting to orbit back. It's kind of cramped, it's kind of primitive, but it works really well. So we're spending $60 to $70 million a seat for that. The price keeps going up. It's still cheaper than flying up on the shuttle was, but it's expensive. So for the foreseeable future, we'll be doing that. Now, NASA is working on their Orion capsule, which is the only part left of the former Constellation program to return to the moon. They canceled everything but the capsule. So they're building that. We've got Elon Musk building the Dragon capsule of SpaceX, which should be man-rated in less than 18 months. So that'll be very exciting because now you'll have a private company sending crews into space. And there's two or three other companies that are working on orbital craft as well, Boeing and a couple of others, that should be created pretty soon, and they'll be able to send people up in orbit. So it's a question of kind of who arrives at the starting line first. NASA's problem, of course, is that they've got this capsule but nothing to put it on at the moment. So, you know, there's always talk about the Space Launch System, the SLS, and so forth. I think with NASA in particular, we've sort of got this perception of drift. They do have a plan, but it shifted dramatically when Obama took office, and I don't think they've done the best job of really explaining to people what it is they're trying to do, what they plan to do with this whole near-Earth object rendezvous and so forth. You know, it's a harder thing to explain than saying, okay, we're going to Mars, or okay, we're going to go build a base on the moon. We start talking about, well, we're either going to bring an asteroid back to Earth and go explore it, or maybe we'll drive out to the asteroid and we'll explore it out there, and you have to tether to it, drift around and take samples. It just doesn't have the kind of instant sex appeal to go into the moon, or especially Mars does. So they've had a little trouble kind of establishing that in the public mind, I think.
Can you also just briefly talk about Virgin Galactic? Because, you know, Sir Richard Branson is such a huge phenomenon around the world, and we know he's excited about his project. So when is that happening?
Well, that's a good question. It's supposed to be happening within the year. And, you know, Branson's had the ill fortune of trying to predict flight dates, you know, test flights and crewed flight dates, and actual dates of paying passengers, and they keep slipping. So he finally, I was talking to a travel agent that sells seats on the Spaceship Two recently, and she was saying, you know, he's just stopped saying when at this point because he's been bitten too many times by his own schedule. But at this point, I think within 2 years, they're planning to start doing revenue flights. That's, of course, strictly suborbital. So it goes up and you get 10 or 15 minutes of weightless flight as it goes over the top of this large parabolic arc, kind of like the first Mercury flights did. And then it comes back down and glides to a landing on a runway. So there's so many things that make that exciting. He's one of the first ones. You know, it's Rutan's airplane, and it's a beautiful, interesting, different kind of design. It's a very reliable rocket engine that hasn't had many problems in development. There were a couple, but they've ironed them out. And it can take a number of people. I think it could take up to 8 people up on these flights, whereas the next best thing, which is the link space plane can only take one at a time. So, you know, for a couple hundred thousand dollars, you can go up and have your quasi-astronaut experience, and a lot of people are very excited about that. And there's a possibility of doing some microgravity research, although it's such a short-duration flight, it would have to be pretty minor. But, you know, the time is nigh. It should be very, very soon. And like you say, he's an incredibly charismatic character. So of all the people that are doing these kind of ventures, I think he's the one that we really want to succeed the most, because who doesn't love Richard Branson, right?
Exactly. Rod, well, thank you so much for your time and for catching us up on what's going on with spaceflight, because it just seems like it's changing fairly quickly. So thank you so much.
It is great. I hope to talk soon.
That's Rod Pyle, writer, producer, and director, and again, who notably wrote and produced Modern Marvel's Apollo 11 for the History Channel, right here on The Kelly Alexander Show.
KellyAlexanderShow.com.
Ever wonder why, when a big show goes on sale, the tickets always seem to sell out in minutes? No matter how hot an artist is, it seems pretty unlikely that the tickets could go that fast. The interesting thing is, it looks as though some artists don't actually want you to have as much access as you'd think. Joining us on the show to talk about all of this magicalness, which it's not, is our social media expert, Patrick Charles. Patrick, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. How you doing?
Magical. Although this topic has elicited anger for me, so we'll get that in a second. But it's true. Like, how does this even start? Like, within, you know, I understand if it's like whatever, you know, One Direction, and you
think
like all the junior mints are going to get tickets really quickly. But like, I don't understand how, you know, whoever, it's sold in minutes, and then you're screwed and you're in the nosebleeds.
Well, it's pretty bad. It's been going on for a long time, because I can remember going back to, you know, as far as when I was a kid, there were always people that you knew who had tickets for some reason. Mm-hmm. Like, I had a friend in high school whose mother worked for one of the ticketing agents, and he always had tickets for the show the day of the show. He always did. Like, if you just said to him, like, hey, I really wanted to go to this, can you get me some? He said, oh, let me call my mom. And he could always get you tickets, which is kind of a scary thought. However, that was a long time ago, and you didn't really think it was that big of a deal. But now you realize that it has a lot to do with the fact that bands aren't making money off of albums anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So the bad news is, it turns out that bands are scalping their own tickets.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I had no idea. I'm, like, shocked. I almost fell over.
There have been a few reports on this. There was a big one in the New York Times a little while ago. And what's happening is that all those online sort of resellers that you see, like, people say, you know, did you get locked out of a big event? You can, like, come to our website and find tickets. And then sure enough, you go there and you go, like, yeah, they got, like, fourth row for this. Yeah, because what happens is the bands are keeping a block of tickets for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
They're selling them to these sort of resellers, scalpers, mm-hmm. as they should be known. And basically the band's getting a cut.
Wow.
Because they're selling the good tickets marked up to the scalpers, and then the scalpers get the blame. Because you go to a show and you say, oh, I'm dying to see whatever band. And it's like, oh, those damn scalpers charged me so much. But it's actually the band who are facilitating them.
And how did this become known, or how did it come into light?
Well, people have been talking about it for a long time. I mean, you and I both know, like, a lot of tickets are kept for contests and for radio and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's got bigger and bigger, where it's like, the first thing I remember where tickets were really held and nobody was shy about it was in the 80s. There were two instances I saw in the newspaper, full page ads for American Express VIP Gold Circle. And the first one I remember was for Paul Simon for Graceland in the 80s. And the second one was for a Sting tour, when Sting was coming to town. And basically they said, if you're an American Express cardholder, we've got great tickets for you. Don't worry about it. Call us up and get a pair of tickets. And I remember being so mad, not because I wanted to go to either one of those shows,
mm-hmm.
but just thinking that there was this way to just, like, yeah, well, I have this card so I can get great tickets. And you sort of forget about it, because as you get, you know, as you get older, because obviously that the demographic of people who would listen to, you know, Paul Simon and Sting at that time, they were like older people who didn't want to stand in line and didn't want to, you know what I mean, and wait for tickets the old school way. So it seemed like a great means to an end. But in reality, what's happening is the band is saying, yeah, have these tickets, sell them marked up, we'll take some of the money.
This sucks. I'm even more angry now than I was 2 minutes ago. Is there a way for this to stop, and does it happen in every city?
Well, I mean, there's not really a way for it to stop, because a lot of what they're doing now is, like, some bands are saying, well, we're going to have paperless tickets, right? Where it's going to be, you have to use your credit card and you have to sign in with a password and this whole thing. But then a lot of people are complaining about problems trying to log into websites to get tickets when they do go on sale. It seems kind of shady still, mm-hmm. and there's even less of a way to know what's going on because you don't have anything in your hand. Also, of course, you can't transfer an electronic ticket a lot of the time, so it's kind of a drag. As far as it happening around the world, the interesting thing is it happens in the sort of bigger markets. So you will see it definitely in Montreal. But I'll tell you, like, One Direction is playing in New Jersey in July, right? Mm-hmm. July 2nd. So they did this investigation, and they said there were 13,687 seats available, right? Mm-hmm. That's how many seats there were in the hall. Now, what they're saying was available to actual fans is 4,400.
Wow.
Yeah. So the other like 9,000 tickets were held back for scalpers, for, the record label, tour sponsors, fan clubs. Because, you know, a lot of bands are like, hey, sign up at our fan club and you can get front row tickets for like four times the price.
Yeah, I've been there.
So that's part of the thing. So they're scalping their own tickets.
Wow. And are all of the bands doing this, like the major ones and stuff like that?
Yeah, you'll hear a lot of like big bands doing it. Like, I mean, you'll hear people that are selling a lot of tickets, I should say. Taylor Swift, people have been complaining about that. She's had a bunch of shows on her tour where people said that 86% of the tickets were held back.
Wow.
Pink in March was playing at the Izod Center also. And they said that she only had 16% of the tickets available.
I'm so disappointed in these people.
Yeah, because don't you find it crazy if you go onto a website, if they say the tickets are on sale on Thursday and like 11:59, you're in front of your computer and you say, let me try and get tickets. And you punch in best seats available and it's like incredible nosebleeds, not even the same arena. You go, how is that possible?
Wow. I'm so mad. And like, because, yeah, like I've been there with the fan club situation because, you know, my listeners and you know, this is no surprise. I'm a huge Janet Jackson fan. So
sure.
I have ponied up for her before. But it's funny because the last time she was on tour when she was doing those sort of intimate venues and in here in Montreal, she did sort of the Bell Centre Theatre, which is smaller.
Right.
And normally, like, you know, I've been very fortunate where I would say from about 98 until 2011, anytime I saw Janet, I was within the first five rows. And I was willing to pay for it because
sure.
I was like, if I'm going to go see her, I'm going to go see her.
Yeah, everybody has somebody that they want to see that badly.
Yeah. And then, but I got nailed the last time, both times actually, because I actually went to see her in Toronto and contacted someone I knew at the ticket sort of office up there. And I said, you know, get me the best seats that you can, like within reason. Like I wasn't going to pay $500. But
sure.
It was funny. I was still up higher. Like I thought I was going to be in the first five rows. And then I get there and I'm like 20 rows back. And I was like, what the hell is this? And then
I'll tell you.
I come to Montreal and then I got nailed the same situation.
Incredible.
Yeah.
And you know, what's funny is speaking of Janet Jackson, there was one time I went to see her in the 90s and it totally wasn't planned. It was at the Bell Centre in Montreal. One of the first shows I saw there because the Bell Centre's been open since like 96, right? Something mm-hmm. like that. So maybe it was 98 and Janet was coming to town. I had no intention of going, but I was with a couple of friends and we were downtown and all of a sudden it popped into our heads like, hey, let's go see if we can get into Janet Jackson.
Okay.
Right? So we went down to the Bell Centre. We were walking around outside. The show had already started and there were a whole bunch of scalpers outside. We just walked up to the first guy we saw and we said, hey, do you have any tickets? And he pulled out this enormous wad of tickets.
Seriously.
Right? And since the show had started, he sold them to us for $20 each and they were great seats.
Wow. So is that the secret then, Patrick, to sort of like wait it out a little?
Well, I've done that before, and a lot of people have said that. I mean, you're taking a chance. If you don't mind missing maybe the first couple of songs or something, a lot of times the scalpers will cut their losses and
right.
just give you the tickets super cheap, even though, you know, they're kind of taking a bath on them. But you know what? So they should.
Yeah, they should. Well, that actually makes sense because I was down near the Bell Centre here in Montreal, which is our big arena, the other week for a concert. And like I wasn't going to the concert, but we were broadcasting. And it was funny because after everybody rushed in to see the concert, you could see the scalpers going around going, hey, like just trying
yeah.
to get rid of them. So now you've just explained what I saw.
Absolutely. Discount tickets.
Discount ticket. Yeah. And you were right because it was about, I would say this was probably about 9, 10, well, actually, no, sorry. This would have been earlier because the show started earlier. So I would say like by 7:45, I was seeing the scalpers going a little like, hey, want this, want that. So they were cutting their losses about 15, 20 minutes after the show started.
Absolutely. The same thing is going on with sporting events as well, of course, because you know that a lot of times when you go to hockey games, baseball games, football games, the same sort of thing happens. People get great seats and they get them through scalpers. That's just the way it is. I mean, the artists and the management, everybody are reselling their tickets, and you'll see more and more of that online. There's actually there's a group called Fan Freedom, and they do a lot of investigations into what's happening with the concert business and with sports as well. But if you go to their website, fanfreedom.org, you can see a lot more information about this. It's pretty crazy.
Wow. I have to say, like, I appreciate that I'm now schooled on this, but now I want to punch a bunch of people in the face. So,
Taylor Swift, One Direction.
Exactly. All these people. Patrick, thank you so much for this. I really appreciate it.
Thanks.
This is our social media expert, Patrick Charles. If you want to learn more about him, on our website, KellyAlexanderShow.com. And you can also follow him on Twitter, @GetPatrick.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Forgiving someone who hurt you isn't always an easy thing to do, but would you ever be able to forgive someone who is responsible for the death of one of your loved ones? Lisa Gibson joins us to tell us about her story of grief and forgiveness. She lost her brother in the 1988 terrorist bombing of Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie, Scotland. Lisa is the founder and executive director of the Peace and Prosperity Alliance, which helps to serve and build bridges of understanding and trust with other cultures. Lisa, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, Lisa, can you actually take us back for a moment and tell us a little bit about your brother and the moment that you heard about the bombing on Flight 103?
Well, actually, it happened in 1988, December 21st, and I had actually just come home from my first term of my first year of college and was really looking forward to seeing my brother. It was Christmas break, and he was actually on his way home for Christmas to see the family after having been away serving in the Army for 2 years. When we found out the news that he'd been killed.
And how long did it take for you to, I guess, have the news sink in that your brother, you know, wasn't going to make it home?
Honestly, for me, it was, I was 18 years old, so I wasn't really emotionally prepared for something of this magnitude. Our family was kind of thrust into the public eye, and you know, all these events are sort of playing out in international media as we're trying to personally deal with this. And I didn't have the wherewithal to really know how to respond. So I kind of went into this place of more of survival, of just hoping that if I could keep moving forward, maybe I could make this all just become, you know, a bad dream. And we didn't immediately get my brother's body back, and in fact, we didn't get it for 2 weeks, so we couldn't have a funeral. So I actually immediately, when Christmas break was over, I kind of went back to school thinking if I just throw myself into studies, maybe that will help this sort of all go away. And I kind of created this scenario that maybe he was alive somewhere else. And so I was deeply, in the initial first 2 weeks, in a place of denial.
And how were you in the following months? Like, you know, did anger creep in? Did you sort of go through those stages that everyone talks about?
Yeah, I think for me, though, it came in a very unlinear way because there was always so many unanswered questions. We didn't have the natural progression that a normal person has of having the funeral and the closure. And so I would, I'd go through, you know, periods of anger and despair, and then I kind of just spiraled into this place of just really deep sorrow because I struggled with not being able to say goodbye and a lot of the things that people deal with in a traumatic death. And because of the nature of his death being so far away, I was so disconnected in so many ways from it. I didn't really have the ability to kind of deal with it the way that normal people do. But I think for me, I took it sort of internally. I looked at it through sort of the lens of my own faith, and that kind of gave me courage to walk forward.
Were you able to... Were you angry right away at the people that were responsible for this? Like, did you channel some of your feelings towards them right away?
Actually, my first encounter with the anger was really when I went back to school. I actually immediately went back to school, and I was confronted with hearing my professor, my political science professor, stood up in our class, and he was actually from Iran. And at the time, they thought it was a retaliation for the U.S. accidentally shooting down an Iranian passenger plane. And he actually stood up and basically condoned the actions because it was, in his view, an eye for an eye. And that was my first jolt out of my place of sort of denial to the reality that there were people around the world that didn't agree with me. And my anger actually was directed initially towards him. And then from there, I think there was more anger. But I realized that I needed to find a way to deal with it in a much more healthy way. And that's kind of how I tried to walk it out.
At what point did you feel that you needed to create something positive out of this obviously very horrible and tragic situation?
For me, it was a very quick transition because I realized that I could not bring my brother back. And my nature is kind of more of an activist or change agent type of person. So I immediately set my sights on, well, maybe I can prevent something like this from happening or keep other people from being harmed in this way. So I did my senior thesis on Islamic terrorism, trying to learn the ins and outs of terrorism and why someone would do this. And in the end, I realized that at the heart of terrorism is hate and fear. And so I knew that the only way to effectively respond is to walk in the opposite spirit. And so that's the path I've taken, is to try to take this tragedy and overcome evil with good.
Joining us on the Kelly Alexander Show is Lisa Gibson, founder and executive director of the Peace and Prosperity Alliance. For more information on Lisa and her work, you can check out their website, peaceandprosperityalliance.org. In the end, I suppose, what made you, I know we sort of just briefly talked about how you needed to change from, you know, turning into that bitter, angry person, but what made you want to forgive? Because that's a huge step as well.
For me, initially, it was just because I grew up in a Christian home where the Bible said to forgive. So initially, it was just an intellectual decision that I need to forgive before I really felt it. So I kind of made a decision first in my mind, I'm going to do this, because I knew that I didn't want to be crippled with bitterness. Even at the age of 18, I recognized that people who were unforgiving were not necessarily happy people. So I just kind of made the decision first, and then as I began to walk that out, I began to feel it.
Now, if I understand things correctly, back in 2005, you actually had a very rare opportunity to meet and speak with Muammar Gaddafi, who had welcomed the terrorist responsible for the bombing back in Libya. What was that like, and what was the significance of the gift you brought him, and what message did you want him to know?
For me, I kind of had taken this posture. I'd been working in Libya for about 7 years at that point. I'd been building bridges of reconciliation. I had actually worked with the Gaddafi Foundation and had gone to Libya on a personal reconciliation trip in 2005, hoping to meet with him. He chose not to on that trip. I later met with him in 2009 when he came to speak at the UN. And honestly, the posture at that moment was really to communicate the message that not only have I forgiven, but I have taken this tragedy and this horrific thing that you've done, and I've used it to help the people of Libya who are still suffering. And so it was more of a message of love triumphing over hate. And I felt like it was a very important thing for me to show that, because at the heart of terrorism is hate and fear, that I was not crippled. There are at least a couple people that were going to move beyond this and do something positive. And I think that was the posture I took in the meeting with him. And surprisingly, he very well received that. And at the end, I gave him just a small token of goodwill. I gave him a cross pen, and to me that was just kind of a symbol of redemption, of this idea of taking a bad thing and turning it into good, and to sort of communicate that message to him. And he was very serious throughout the whole meeting. It was only towards the end when I gave him that small gift that he actually, his countenance softened for a brief moment, and he actually smiled, and he said, "Thank you." And I could tell that he was actually authentically touched. So for me to see, you know, a level of humanity in him, even for that brief moment, knowing all of the horrific things that he had done, was very meaningful.
Can you talk to me a little bit about 9/11? Because, you know, obviously that was a huge situation for so many people to undergo, just like you had gone through years before. I'm just wondering, you've obviously, I'm sure, spoken to family members and such that dealt with that. Did you find it was a very similar situation with what you went through?
Well, you know, interestingly, I actually was in D.C. At the Watergate Hotel across the river from the Pentagon on that day, and I was actually at a conference of the National Governors Association when the whole thing happened in New York. They immediately shut down the conference. They evacuated all the governors, and we were stuck there in D.C. as the city was shut down. So I actually kind of lived that firsthand as well. We went up to the top floor of the hotel looking over to see what was happening at the Pentagon. So it was very real to me as well, and I actually felt even more compelled in the middle of that we've got to do something to help people understand that there's a different way.
And did you, in speaking with, I'm sure, family members, did you find that they had a similar, like, was it a similar experience for them, like, with what you went through, like, all those years earlier? Because I'm assuming it's similar emotions.
Absolutely. I think in the Boston Marathon people I know are probably wrestling through some of this. At least those guys have been caught. For years, when you didn't know who was responsible, though, that was probably the hardest thing. You didn't even know who to direct your anger at. For us, we had years of waiting to try to bring a guy to trial, and you know, more years of having Libya eventually accept responsibility. I think, you know, catching Osama bin Laden probably helped bring some level of closure.
Mm-hmm.
But every time another terrorist, you know, invades America or attacks somebody in some place or tries to blow up a bomb in some public transportation system or something, people, they're immediately triggered again. I was even triggered a little bit again when I heard about Boston Marathon, just that level of traumaticness.
Right.
So I think we'll continue to experience that to some degree throughout our whole life, because it is something that at the core of it is designed to cause fear and chaos.
I wanted your thoughts as well on, you mentioned Osama bin Laden, like when they caught him, and, you know, that was, you know, May of last year, I guess it was, or, you know, just, it just seems like it was not that long ago. Do you think, because it was such a long period, though, between when they caught him and when 9/11 actually happened, it was like, you know, over 10 years or whatever. Do you think that some of the victims' family, because there's so many people that were affected by all of this, do you think there was a lot of people that might have been holding on to anger and all that sort of stuff and pointing it so much at Osama that when they actually did catch him, it was maybe not as much closure as they would have hoped because they'd hung so much emotion on it?
It's possible. I mean, I think everyone deals with grief differently. Some people, I mean, even the people in the Lockerbie case, many of the families still are not at peace. They still have this bitterness that is this, you know, sort of eating them alive, even though the bomber's dead and Gaddafi's dead. And so it doesn't always bring the closure that you need. That's why for me, I recognize no matter what happens on the justice end of it, which is important, I am not going to carry this for the rest of my life. I don't think my brother would want me to live in that place of holding this in and allowing it to consume me. So for me, the only logical thing was to take it and to turn it into something good. And I hope that many of the families from 9/11 have found a way to channel that negative and hurt into something positive.
What have you learned the most through your work with your nonprofit organization?
I think the most important principle I've learned with the Peace and Prosperity Alliance is that it's so important for us to go to those places in the world where we have differences in views, differences in religion, differences in politics, that serve as a catalyst to some degree of the wrong way we look at each other. Because when I first went to Libya in 2004, I was shocked to find out that the people there thought I hated them. And, of course, I didn't hate them because I didn't even know them. I mean, there was such a huge divide between our countries, and that country was really closed from the world for 30-some years, that I realized in those face-to-face dialogues, despite our differences, there's a lot more commonality, and it's in that place of relationship at really a heart level and people-to-people level that you start to break down some of the wrong patterns of thought that we have against one another, and that helps to dispel a lot of the extremist rhetoric. And I know being on the news in Libya and in Afghanistan and Iraq, It lets at least some people see there are people from America who are here and trying to help us. And that is important to helping to break down those barriers.
And in the grand scheme of things, how have people responded to your work in, you know, trying to bridge these gaps between the developed and the developing world?
It's been extraordinarily received, honestly. Even myself, I'm surprised as I've continued to just walk that out step by step, that the doors just swing wide open. In fact, I was in Libya during the revolution, and we were on a relief trip bringing medical supplies, and we actually drove in from Egypt to Benghazi, and we were meeting with some of the leaders of the revolution there, and when they found out my story and my connection, they asked me to speak, and I spoke to a crowd of probably 100,000 people in Freedom Square in Benghazi on the day that the International Court issued the arrest warrant for Gaddafi. And just to let them know I was there to help them, to hear their stories, to encourage them, and continue to help them rebuild, meant so much. And I could tell it because in the middle of my speech, they actually interrupted me and just started cheering, "Thank you, Lisa," in English. And I realized to me that was the reason that I'd walked down this path, is that to me showed what it was to take this tragedy and turn it around to help other people.
Well, Lisa, you're amazing. It's been so great to speak to you, and we really appreciate you sharing all your information and your thoughts. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
That was Lisa Gibson, founder and executive director of the Peace and Prosperity Alliance. For more information on her nonprofit organization, check out peaceandprosperityalliance.org.
Bring on the
Remix.
Remix.
Singing in the shower, picking petals off of flowers like, do she love me, do she love me not, love me not, I ain't a player, I
Grande with The Way, the Jody Denbroder radio edit on The Kelly Alexander Show. Thank you so much to my guests this week, including Tony Martinez, Rod Pyle, Lisa Gibson, and the always amazing Patrick Charles. I want to leave you with your inspirational quote of the week, this time coming from Miss Oprah Winfrey. Challenges are gifts that force us to search for a new center of gravity. Don't fight them. Just find a new way to stand. Make sure to check us out on social media. Lots of interviews for you on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/Kelly Alexander Show. You can also follow us for great information on Twitter @KAlexanderShow, on our Facebook page, The Kelly Alexander Show. And you can also drop me a note, Kelly@KellyAlexanderShow.com. Have an awesome week. You and I will chat soon.